Pascal develops an argument which is based specifically on the Christian worldview. It's not merely theism. In fact, he didn't really hold the natural theological arguments in high regard. I think he was wrong, but he gives a very strong argument based on the human condition. He's attempting to explain the human condition better than other worldviews. The statement I have at the beginning is, if he exalts himself, I humble him. If he humbles himself, I exalt him. And I go on contradicting him until he understands that he is a monster that passes all understanding. Now, it's somewhat paradoxical, isn't it? I go on contradicting him until he understands he is a monster that passes all understanding. What's encoded there is that no merely human answer to the human condition is adequate. You need a transcendent revelation to understand who we are as human beings. That is, that we are great and noble because we're created in God's image and likeness, yet we are debased and miserable because we are fallen. So in a sense, we have two natures, our original nature, which we retain, but a second nature that corrupts the original nature. So we are not purely great, although some want to make that claim. We are not purely debased or miserable, although others will make that claim. We are both great and miserable, but to understand our condition, we need information, we need knowledge from a source beyond ourselves. That is, that we were created good, that we subsequently fell, and that the fall has corrupted an originally good creation, the goodness of the human person. Now, Pascal's argument does not begin with the Bible. It begins with a hypothesis, certainly. But it doesn't appeal to biblical verses about our being made in the image and likeness of God and our being fallen, like Genesis 1:26, image and likeness of God, Mark 7:21 through 23, all the evils that come out of the heart. He basically appeals to various factors of human experience. And so I can't really reproduce the genius of Pascal rhetorically or philosophically. All I can do is bear witness to it, give you as many quotes as possible. When you write about Pascal, you're tempted to merely quote him over and over again. Most people that write about Pascal will quote him at length because of his stylistic acumen, because of his simple touch. The images that he uses, the parables, are quite arresting. And I think Pascal would be happy with playing this song from Stevie Ray Vaughan. Let me explain. I think the blues, as a form of music and as a reflection of culture, contain the element of hope as well as fighting and battling despair. It's a theme in blues music. Blues music basically comes out of American black gospel music. And even you can hear refrains in blues like, you know, "O Lord," or "Lordy," or "God have mercy." Now, it's probably the case that the singer may not be literally saying that to God, but those phrases are there for a reason. Because it comes out of that experience of African Americans being taught Christianity, a bogus form of it, that they were intrinsically subservient, but nevertheless believing it and ultimately appropriating that religion for their own liberation. It's a tremendous story of the providence and goodness of God and how God turns things on its head so often, so many amazing ways. But in the blues, you have the category often of lament. And it may be very simple, like this song, don't look for really profound lyrics. It's called "The Sky is Crying." It's basically about a broken relationship. But interesting, look at how it's put. The sky is crying. It's not "I'm crying, my baby's crying." The sky is crying. It's really something like Romans 8. The whole universe groans together in travail awaiting its redemption. It's a cosmic sense. There's something wrong with the world. And there's kind of a hope that maybe one day it will get better. And the music itself is simple. The blues form, whether it's 12 bar, 16 bar, whatever, is fairly simple. It's usually a 4-4 beat. Sometimes it can be a shuffle kind of beat. It's a basic, simple kind of form. As Dickie Betts once put it, with blues there's not much to hide behind. You have three chords, basically, to work with. And so to shine in this medium, you have to develop a particular voice, a particular style of approaching the music, which is distinctively yours. Now, the reason I want to play this, if you don't like it, don't worry, it's only 5 minutes, okay? It's only 5 minutes if you don't like it. But if you don't like it, there is something wrong with you. This particular musician, Stevie Ray Vaughan, very sadly died in 1990 in a helicopter crash. And he led a rough life. He was a drug addict and all the rest. And he came clean several years before he died through, I think, a 12-step kind of process. Whether or not he came to Christ, I don't know. There's rumors on that. But this is a song called The Sky is Crying. And I think the words indicate something about the roots in the gospel music, even if it's more of a lamentation, not a lot of hope per se, embedded in the lamentation. But the one fantastic thing about blues also is that the music itself is both painful and joyful at the same time. And I think it captures something about human beings. The basic message of Pascal is that we are deposed royalty, that we bear the marks of the crown, so to speak, with our abilities, our aptitudes. We transcend the rest of nature in our goodness. But we also transcend the rest of nature in our twistedness, in our warpedness, in our perversions. We do things to each other animals would never do to each other. I mean, what animal tries to engage in genocide with another animal? Something like that. So I think in the very music, especially the way Stevie Ray plays electric guitar, you get this intensity of pain and joy simultaneously. And in the music, you get the basic form of a kind of lament. It's called Blues at Sunrise. It's a collection of slow blues. And it's kind of a searching, a yearning, sort of a painful quest for joy. And that's why, you know, when you listen to blues, you want to make certain kinds of faces, you know. You just have to do that sometimes. I listen to that when I ride my bike, and some people must think I'm really weird when I pass them, you know. Well, I think that's an illustration that Pascal might appreciate. Let me talk a little bit about Pascal as a person, how he's been misunderstood. I talk about this in the book. A lot of people appropriate Pascal as a fideist, and they quote his famous statement that the heart has reason that reason knows nothing of, to mean that any kind of argument for Christianity, any kind of reasoned approach, is out of court. It's not appropriate. That's too simplistic. That's really not the full-fledged corpus of Pascal. That's one fragment. Now, the Pensées are a collection of fragments. He didn't finish the book. He was going to write an apologetic tome, basically. And he died before he finished, age 39. So we have fragments, some larger than others. The wager fragment, the most famous of all, was one piece of paper that was written on from all different directions. It wasn't like notes like this. It was maybe something like this, something on the side, arrows, was folded different places. And a lot of people will take the wager, and which is very difficult to interpret in many ways, and divorce it from the rest of his work. So part of the problem with Pascal is putting all the pieces together. I think it can be done if you understand something of his background, the religious climate of the day, his letters. If you read his polemical treatises against the Jesuits, the provincial letters. If you really study the Pensées and try to figure out what the different fragments mean and where they would have fit into an overall apologetic, because he gives you some programmatic statements. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Now, what I have found most fruitful in Pascal are two things. One, his argument from the human condition. And I was captured by this very early on as a Christian. I think it was 1977. I pulled down a volume from the great books that my mother had and read about Pascal, read the Pensées. And I was quite captivated by his understanding of the human condition and his argument that really only Christianity explains the human condition and gives it a final meaning. There are things about Pascal that I disagree with, He rejected natural theology for a variety of reasons, which I won't go over again. I think we can use his argument from the human condition as part of a cumulative case argument. Just use it as one of the many lines of evidence that converges on the Christian hypothesis. So we may want to talk about, first of all, the concept of truth, the importance of rationality, the theistic arguments, do some negative apologetics against other worldviews, naturalism, pantheism, polytheism, and so on. And then we can use this argument, which is a specifically Christian argument. It's not just there is a God who created human beings. It is that there is a God who created human beings in his image and likeness, and they're fallen. They're sinful beings. But they still have a residue of greatness. Now, one of the geniuses of this argument is it's Christian theism. It's not just theism. And it's specifically addressing the anthropological dimension. So it has immediate pertinence to people. You might lose some people on actual infinites and so on. Okay. You're talking about who they are and why they do what they do. You probably immediately have their attention. So Pascal is trying to understand the greatness and misery of the human condition. And I've taught this for years, and one of my students a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, challenged me and said, how many times have you given this argument in front of an unbelieving audience or a mixed audience? And I said, well, I think only once. And it was only part of an argument. So I was asked to give a talk in 2000 at the University of Colorado, Boulder, as part of a big campus crusade outreach. And I gave this argument, Pascal's argument, and related the biblical view of humanity to two other worldviews. I won't do that tonight, but I might throw it in. New Age thought and postmodern thought. And I argued through that this is a best explanation argument. It's not inductive, it's not deductive, it's abductive. It's appealing to the best explanation to the divergent facts of the human condition. And it can be related to other arguments, but it seems to be a pretty powerful argument in and of itself. That seemed to go pretty well. And I did it again about a year and a half ago in a theology forum, again at CU Boulder, to about 40 people in more of a classroom setting, not a big lecture setting, and entertained questions and comments from the students and ended up interacting quite a bit with the professor, Wes Morriston, who's, I think, a theist, but actually quite a skeptic, particularly perturbed about the problem of evil and writes a lot of arguments against apologetics and so on. It seemed to do fairly well. So you might say, in some ways, it's road-tested. I think it's a good argument. I think it's a pretty powerful argument. Now, what he's trying to do is make sense of the human condition. If you're trying to develop an integrated worldview, certainly the human condition needs to be explained. The argument appeals to a sense of one's personal identity and meaning, self-understanding, and desire to explore who one is, but it's also larger because it's about all people, not just about you as a particular person. So, in the human condition, we find greatness and misery. One of his most famous quotes is this, from Ponce. What sort of a freak, then, is man? How novel, how monstrous, how chaotic, how paradoxical, how prodigious. Judge of all things, feeble earthworm. Repository of truth, sink of doubt and error. Glory and refuse of the universe. That's often quoted, the glory and refuse of the universe. Now you tell me, when you're looking at human achievement and human debauchery, what sorts of things would you present? Remember, we start the argument just by looking at the human scene. And then we try to explain the various facets of the human condition according to rival hypotheses. What are some things you would bring out? The misery, the greatness of humanity. Let's start with greatness. Particularly greatness with respect to things we don't see in the animal world. Creativity. What kind? Be more specific. Blues? Music, art, painting, poetry, architecture, medicine, compassion, love, self-sacrifice. You do see that in the animal world to some degree, though. What else? Human excellence. Yeah, cognition. Arguments, philosophy. Reflecting on life. Yes? Something over here? Well, animals communicate, but we communicate at a deeper, more sophisticated level. Well, they can, but they can to some degree, but you can't really teach an animal to use symbols abstractly in the way humans use symbols abstractly. You can get them to press different levers, and so it's amazing to me that some of these scientists are so adamant and so passionate about trying to teach animals to communicate in a way similar to humans. What's the agenda? Darwinism. They have to be only different in degree from us. They can't be different in kind from us. Because if they're different in kind, then you have to account for us in a non-evolutionary way. If they're different in degree, then you can maybe account for it in terms of gradual, impersonal processes. But if we're different in kind, if we have a different essence than animals, then you're in the world of theism. You're in the world of a created structure, a created order. And for all the energy expended for decades, the results are pretty darn paltry. So the sophistication of language, symbol systems, art, architecture, music, certain acts of heroism maybe, things in that category. Now what about misery, debauchery, debasement? Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. That's a way into it. Failure, lack, frustration, pain, suffering, especially undeserved suffering, gratuitous cruelty, things like that. In fact, the human beings torture each other, think up all these exquisite ways of making each other miserable, behead each other, crash airplanes into buildings, kill innocent people. You can just talk about everyday cruelty, everyday pettiness, greed, backbiting, gossip. There's a great Latin phrase that I think explains the human condition really well. It's called corruptio optima pessima. I don't know too many Latin phrases, but this is a winner. Haven't heard it in a blues song recently. But corruptio optima pessima means there's nothing worse than the corruption of the best. There's nothing worse than the corruption of the best. So if human beings have these exquisite potentials, intellectually, morally, and aesthetically, what is great becomes terrible when it's twisted. So human beings can create devices to try to kill millions and millions of fellow human beings. And they can attempt to find cures for diseases that kill millions and millions of human beings. So human beings can write great works of literature, such as written by Dante, Dostoevsky, or they can write Mein Kampf. Corruptio optima pessima. How much evil can an ant do? Think of an ant gone wrong. Okay? Has hat on backwards, real bad attitude. Doesn't want to obey what the rest of the ants do. Protests. Makes signs saying, on strike forever. How much harm can an ant gone wrong really do? Not much. How much wrong can a house cat gone wrong do? A fair amount. More. How much can a bear gone wrong? Okay, worse. But is it anything like what human beings do to each other and do to the natural environment? In fact, do to God, if you will, in terms of blasphemy, ignorance. The greater something is, the greater the potential for evil. Corruptio optima pessima. That's the human condition from a biblical framework. So you don't want to immediately hit people with, you're a sinner, all of sin, necessarily. That's true. But you can appeal to human experience, and not only the fact that we're sinners. In fact, Nancy Piercy writes about this in her book, Total Truth, which I'm reading now, which is developing a Christian worldview that's adequate to have a significant cultural witness for the glory of God. Her thesis is we have divided minds. We have our faith in one, on one side, and we have our public life on the other, and they don't really meet. But she says you can only understand the concept of fallenness if you understand the concept of an originally good creation. Because we'll talk about this more later with respect to the problem of evil, but evil is good gone wrong. Evil is not an independently existing substance, if you will. It's always parasitic on something good. So rape is parasitic on good and healthy sexual relationships. It distorts that. It twists it. Or let's say someone who has tremendous oratorical skills. That is a good, but it can be used for evil because Hitler could influence powerfully people through his oratory. Okay? So evil is good gone wrong. To even talk about fallenness, sinfulness, you have to talk about a corrupted original good. And sometimes I think when we talk to unbelievers, we emphasize sinfulness, falling short, being estranged from God, alienated from God. But the point is this, we're all damaged goods. And anything good that remains in the human person or the human condition at large or the universe is because God created it good. And we have not lost the image of God. Some people argue that. It's not true. The image of God has not been erased in human beings. Otherwise, we would cease to be human beings. That's what makes us human beings. We bear the image and likeness of God, but it has been corrupted and debased such that every part of the human person is out of alignment or skewed with God's original intention. That's what the doctrine of total depravity really means. It doesn't mean you're as bad as you possibly could be, and so is everybody else. It means that every aspect of the human person is skewed and out of alignment with the principles and the directives of God. And if God is infinitely holy, perfectly holy, then we're all in very, very deep trouble. There's no intrinsic goodness we can appeal to for salvation or for merit. But we are creatures, and we're very good creatures, right? God created all these things and said it's good. When he comes to humans, he says what? Very good. Image and likeness of God. Now, I can't do any kind of justice to Pascal because you have to read him for yourself. I try to give a lot of quotes in On Pascal, but he has a very common human touch about the greatness and misery. For instance, when you're trying to think and read and a fly is buzzing in your ear. You know, here's the Lord of the universe who can't think straight because a fly is bugging him. You know, it's kind of a comical picture of the human situation. And Pascal also is tremendously helpful when he's discussing the seriousness of the human condition in a broken and fallen world. When he's arguing against diversion, I don't have enough material on that really in the outline, but some very poignant and arresting statements in the Pensée about how people give up on finding any answer to reality. And so they divert themselves from the questions by playing games or by aspiring to high positions of office or by womanizing or whatever it may be. They are diverting themselves from even thinking about the question, who am I in the universe? You know, basically, who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What can I hope? What can I know? Those kinds of perennial reflective questions that all philosophies and religion worth their salt address. But even that, ingeniously, can be used as part of a Christian argument for the human condition being fallen and therefore by nature, we want to distract ourselves from any truth that would indict us. It's congenital, okay? Since the fall, it's congenital that we want to distract ourselves from truth. In some sense, we want the supernatural or the sacred, you know, that argument from longing, the God-shaped vacuum is a shorthand phrase for Pascal. But at the same time, we try to fill this infinite abyss with everything except God. Through experiences, through extreme sports, through entertainment, through sexual aberrations, through drug abuse, through alcohol abuse. I mean, you name it. These are all attempts to fill an empty self, if you will. And they show a moral agent gone wrong. And that is one of the most difficult and pressing things that we face as apologists, is that popular culture is pretty much set up systematically to distract you and divert you from pursuing the deeper questions of existence. Now, sometimes it pops through. Sometimes a song, sometimes maybe a play, a movie, I suppose supernatural power of God on television, a theme, a question will come through that if you thought about it for 5 seconds might lead you in the right direction. Right? But much of it is so fast, so superficial, so loud, it's nothing but a distraction from God. C.S. Lewis writes about this in the Screwtape Letters, where the senior demon's writing to the junior demon, and he says, when the man starts to get a thought, a coherent, careful thought, remind him that he's hungry. Remind him he needs to go eat lunch, and before you know it, he's reading the newspaper and you're safe. That is one of the battles we have to face, is keeping people on the subject. That's why I love assigning these apologetic interviews. Because if people consent to them, they have given you 45 minutes of your time and their time, 45 minutes of their time with you to talk about important things. How often does that happen? In a worldview context. Now, you see accounts that someone said never. How often does that happen? Not often. Now, it may happen at some level in a counseling situation, but often that doesn't get to the worldview level. It doesn't get to matters of theology. Oftentimes it doesn't. With a non-Christian therapist, it would not, typically. Or it might get to the wrong worldview. Someone's a New Age therapist or past life regression or something like that. So you're basically asking for 45 minutes of someone's day to talk about significant things without distractions. And there's almost 100 of you that will be doing it. It could be very significant for you and for the person. So we have to cope with diversions. We need to try to explain the greatness and the misery. Now, Pascal throws down the gauntlet and he says, man's greatness and wretchedness are so evident that the true religion must necessarily teach us that there is in man some great principle of greatness and some great principle of wretchedness. It must account for such amazing contradictions. And his basic thesis is that non-Christian worldviews, whether religious or secular, make one of two mistakes. They either emphasize greatness at the expense of misery, or emphasize misery at the expense of greatness. And his claim is they don't have the conceptual resources adequate to explain our divine origin and our subsequent fall. So they don't have that as components of their worldview. Okay, can you give me an example? Let's start out with greatness without misery. And the idea is that if you view us as excellent, supreme, or superb, without the debauchery, it's an imbalanced account. It's partial. Now, can you think of worldviews that tend to do that? Yeah, the New Age worldview. What does it basically say about human beings? We're all great. There's no sin. There's only negative thinking, bad thought patterns, ignorance of our true identity as being one with God. Yeah, Rogerian psychology. You have all the answers within yourself, so the therapist is to bring out what you already know. It's no real sense of deep dysfunction, deep disease within the person. Something that can be worked out therapeutically without some kind of a radical answer. Anything else? Greatness without misery? Interestingly, in a sense, believe it or not, Islam. We'll talk about this later, but Islam does not have a doctrine of original sin. It teaches that human beings are all born Muslims. And through ignorance or being misled, they may go astray and not follow the straight path. All they need is to know the law, the straight path that's found in the Quran, which was revealed to the last and the greatest and the seal of the prophets, Allah. Now, they bow down before Allah and they don't view themselves as supreme. But interestingly, they do not have a doctrine of original sin. There's an original mistake by Adam. He's forgiven. And now we all start out on a level playing field after that. Anything else? Greatness without misery? Or greatness without sufficient misery? Yes. Right. Right. Now, you have a concept that something is holding back progress, holding back a just society, which is limited to a certain class of people. But if that is dealt with through the proper means, through revolution, you can exterminate the cause of evil. And the great Marxist hope was utopia, was a classless society where the state would wither away. Didn't quite happen. Was the greatest false promise of the 19th century, Marxism, and the 20th century. Anything else? Greatness without misery. How about misery without greatness? Freudian psychology. Yeah, pretty much. We are a product of unconscious forces, a collection of neuroses. Freud said that the purpose of psychotherapy was to reach an acceptable level of misery. No God, no telos, no soul, no afterlife. And the self is governed largely by unconscious and irrational forces. Pretty bleak view. Doesn't mean it's false necessarily, but it's a bleak view. And Freudians are famous for debunking great achievements. Well, that's really a product of reaction formation. Or that's really a product of some other psychological mechanism. It's like you're seeing through things. You know, C.S. Lewis said in The Abolition of Man, if you see through everything, there's nothing to see at all. It's got to be a bedrock somewhere. Anything else? Misery without greatness. Well, it depends on what kind of atheism. If you're an optimistic atheist, you think, such as Paul Kurtz, you feel the throb of the universe, and that's good enough to support a person and support a civilization. That's a bill of goods. Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about non-dualistic Hinduism, you're one with Brahman, so you are the supreme. But if you're talking about the cause and effect world of karma, you want to get off that as soon as you possibly can, because it's hopeless. It will never be redeemed. It has to be escaped. And it's only illusory anyway. So it's kind of a combination. But again, it's not that human beings have fallen morally from a state of goodness. It's that human beings don't realize their true identity as Brahman, at least this type of Hinduism. There are different forms of Hinduism. But this is the one that people in the West tend to gravitate towards. Any kind of nihilism would be misery without greatness. Any kind of chronic, perpetual hopelessness. Even Sartre was not a nihilist. Existentialism tries to carve meaning out of a meaningless world, but he said that man is a useless passion. Man is condemned to be free, and so on. Well, Nietzsche was in some ways a harbinger of existentialism, in some ways a harbinger of postmodernism. He certainly attacked the idea of objective truth, rationality as a way of determining truth through a shared consensus of rational principles. He was a vehement opponent of Christianity, certainly. Nietzsche, it's been said, looked out upon a vast, meaningless universe without God. You know, God is dead, for we have killed him, you and I. I remember I read that last week, I think it was. And the only thing that could hearten him was the idea of the Übermensch, that there are a small number of people, that and the eternal return, there are a small number of people who transcend conventional morality and create their own values. That comes right out of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. They're creators. They're not reactors. They create their own values. And they love themselves passionately. Some have thought that's the only way Nietzsche could endure this vast, meaningless universe that he saw. Was that there are people who have virtue. The virtue of the strong, the creative, the unique, the one that are not reactors. They are initiators. They are instigators. And they don't take their orders from anyone else over man. But they die, and there's no afterlife. But there is an eternal return, which he tried to find meaning in. But it's just the same thing over and over again. There's no telos to it. There's no guiding purpose. It's just endless repetition. All right. So Pascal's argument, he's dealing with Montaigne as misery without greatness and the Stoics as greatness without misery. They can sort of typify two errors, two classic types of errors. He says there's a need for a third way, a tertium quid. And we find this in the biblical account. That we're created in God's image, but we're fallen. Yet there remains a remnant of goodness in the human condition. We don't lose our distinctively human capacities to cultivate the earth, Genesis 2, and to have dominion, Genesis 1. And that's celebrated in Psalm 8. We don't lose that. And whether you're a Christian or a Hindu or an atheist, you're still involved in world-shaping activities by virtue of being a human agent, assuming you have the capacities and so on. You communicate, you build things, you destroy things, you plan, you have an effect on the larger world. But the genius of the Christian position is that we can have really the highest view that fits the evidence of the Christian, of the human person rather, on Christian grounds. And also say we are in desperate need of a redemption outside of ourselves. Again, corruptio optima pessima. There's nothing worse than the corruption of the best. And the argument for him is pursuing the best explanation. We want to argue that the human nature is dual. We find it in ourselves, in our own narrative. We find it in the human narrative. And there has to be some kind of a concern that the condition be explained. Again, part of the difficulty we face is the postmodern whatever response. Who are we as human beings? Well, we're messed up. Whatever. What's on MTV? What's the new video game? Now, you have to try to appeal to someone's sense of intellectual curiosity and intellectual possibility sometimes to press people, sort of appeal to their shame. That's what Pascal does. He deals with the flippant skeptic. Well, who can really know that? Why even try to find it out? And he says, basically, this person is worthless as a human being. They're not pursuing answers. They've given up on answers. They've given up on finding a rational meaning to life. And I think sometimes that kind of an approach is basically grabbing somebody by the shirt and say, wait a minute, you can think better than that. Don't give up so fast. You have abilities you're not even using. Can maybe startle someone into thinking. I hope so. We hope to do that with people. But if they're content to have no explanation and not in pursuit of one, what can you do? You can't force them to. Now, we want to place this perspective on the human condition into a larger framework, obviously, of the creation of God, the subsequent fall into sin. We need to show people these are biblical ideas. They fit the evidence. They explain the evidence convincingly. And moreover, we have other arguments for the existence of God. We've talked about that. You don't have to use this argument in isolation. It gains strength when it's combined with other arguments that can lend a hand. Now, in terms of sin, can you argue someone into believing they're a sinner? Biblical concept of sin. What do you think? Yes. In what way can you? Argue them into it now. Guilt. That's one word. Give me a sentence, an argument.
Well, you can show that somebody feels a certain amount of guilt. In the Moreland's argument, he talks about how that guilt must have
Right. Yeah, we have a sense of guilt and wrongdoing even when no human being knows we've done something wrong. Now, how can you explain that? It seems that we understand we're in the presence of a moral authority that we've sinned against. But as was said earlier, you can talk about people's sense of loss, inadequacy, frustration, anger, outrage. And then you have to make sure they turn it back on themselves. There's a line by Bruce Coburn. He says, everybody wants to see justice done on someone else. So you have to turn it back on yourself. How have you betrayed people? How have you been petty? How have you been a gossip? How have you been cruel? People have done it to you. Have you done it to others? Now, you can put that in a worldview context. You can say Christianity explains human guilt. It doesn't have to explain it away as just a Freudian category of the unconscious acting up. As Schaeffer used to put it, there's true moral guilt. It's objectively existing before an infinitely holy God. But you can't really argue someone into that. You can present the concept. You can illustrate the concept. Only the Holy Spirit can actually convict someone that they are a sinner before God. And moreover, that they need deliverance through Christ. Because this argument is not just creation and fall. It's creation, fall, redemption. That Christ came as a human being to liberate human beings through His perfect life, His death, and His resurrection. He was the God-man, but He was truly human. And before Christ, we can admit our faults without despair, and we can admit our greatness without pride. Some great lines in the Pensée about that. We can come to terms with who we are through Christ and in Christ in a way we can't through any other religion or any other worldview. So you can explain the concept of sin to people. You can try to illustrate it from human behavior, human history, to some degree human psychology, except where notions of psychology have been corrupted by other worldviews. But you can talk about the phenomena of guilt, shame. Have you ever heard of a culture where there was no sense of guilt or no sense of shame whatsoever? Where there were no taboos? There was no sense of a need for atonement or propitiation? I don't think so. You can find that universally. Now, the abductive argument form, as I said, is neither deductive nor inductive. It's an appeal to the best explanation. But it's not the fallacy of affirming the consequent. And I make this point in more detail in the paper I handed out. It's not if P, then Q, Q, therefore P. That is, if humans are created and fallen, then they will show the evidence of greatness of misery. Therefore, they're created in the image and likeness of God, but fallen. If you make it just that simple, it's a fallacy. But if you make it appeal to the best explanation, it's not a fallacy. It's a very well-respected, commonly used argument form. And I explain this more in the paper. And a lot of our explanations in law, in science, and in other areas of life use this best explanation sort of form. That is, here's a surprising fact. What hypothesis best explains this surprising fact? The surprising fact is the greatness and misery of humanity. Is it naturalism? Is it pantheism? Is it polytheism? What accounts for the greatness? What accounts for the misery? You can also add, what gives hope, a reason for hope? Christ, His life, His death, His resurrection. We'll build those arguments more from Scripture later. Okay? That's the kind of argument it is. Now, what's the worth of the argument? I'll spend a little time on the wager here. Should be part of a larger cumulative case argument. It illuminates the meaning of the human condition uniquely. There's so much in Scripture where people are crying out to God about the nature of the universe and the frustrations of being a human being in a fallen world. Think of so many of the Psalms. Think of Romans 8, even, where Paul's looking ahead, but he talks about the universe groaning together in travail. Think about that much maligned but wonderful and so insightful book of Ecclesiastes about what life is like under the sun and what the true meaning of existence is. And we can offer hope through Christ. This is not just a diagnosis or an explanation. It is, in fact, a prescription that human beings east of Eden are under heaven and come and can come to the cross of Christ for redemption. I think you can use this argument in a fairly technical form. I've tried to make it fairly technical in my article. You can use it in sermons. One of my students told me once that she preached this as a sermon, basically the deposed royalty concept, illustrated it from Scripture in a fairly liberal church. And she said the response was very heartening. I think she said, I don't know, 5 or 10 people responded, I want to be redeemed. I want Christ to redeem me from my condition of being a deposed king or queen. I think it's a powerful idea. Why? It's biblical. It's true. And it resonates with people. And you can make it as complex as you want. You can make it very simple. Let me give you the short and dirty version of Pascal's Wager. You can read the chapter. There's a really wrong and stupid way of using Pascal's Wager. And it's the way that it's usually presented in much of the literature. That is to say, well, nobody can really know whether God exists or not. So wager that he does exist. If he does exist, you'll be better off. If he doesn't exist, you won't have lost very much. You ever heard it put that way? It avoids any kind of evidential argumentative engagement in terms of natural theology, reliability of the Bible. It even avoids Pascal's own argument, his anthropological argument. Now, this is impossible to summarize in 5 minutes, is the problem. We should just play more Stevie Ray. Anyway, don't do that. That's the short version. Don't do that argument. Nobody can really know. You're better off if you believe in God. So take a blind leap. Wager that God exists. If he's really there, you're better off than if you don't believe. Because if you don't believe, you go to hell. If you believe, you'll go to heaven. But nobody can really know in this life. What is that saying? There's no knowledge of God in this life. You just have to wager. There's no knowledge. I don't think Pascal wanted to present it that way. What I think he was trying to do is to say that we are sometimes in positions where we have to make momentous decisions under conditions of uncertainty. So we have to carefully assess the prudential environment. Now, if Christianity is true, you have everything to gain if you follow Christ and everything to lose if you don't. That's just the lay of the land. That's the claim that's made. That's the prudential possibility. Now, if you're going to think about Christianity, you should know that. That's the way it's laid out. Other religions are really not laid out with such high stakes, are they? Buddhism, Hinduism, you have reincarnation. There's not an either or, heaven or hell forever. Okay. Some religions say very little about the afterlife. Confucianism, Shintoism. Christianity and Islam are the highest stakes religions going. You should bring that to the table when you consider what religion may be true and what religions may be false. I think it's an incentive for skeptics. It's an incentive. You might say, you may not have certainty about what religion is true, but isn't it worth investigating Christianity given its evidential claims, for one thing, given, let's just say, the anthropological argument. But there are ways of investigating Christianity besides reading Pascal or reading other books. You can expose yourself to Christians. You can associate with them. You can talk with them. You can ask them questions. You can attend religious events. And that's what Pascal wanted the seeker to do. Actually, he's not the seeker. It's the skeptic. He wanted the skeptic to become a seeker. And so he says, look, the prudential situation is very dramatic. It's supercharged. Don't you want to investigate to see whether or not this may be true? And another ingenious part of the wager is that many times what keeps us from believing is not a rational argument that something is false. It's something in our passions. It's actually something irrational. It might be a fear that's irrational. So he famously says, if you want to believe, then take holy water and have masses said. And people go berserk. They go ballistic over this. They say, oh my God, he's just trying to get people to stupefy themselves. The only way you can be a Christian is just to medicate yourself into heaven. Talk about an uncharitable reading of a text. The reading that I take of it is that it's an ingenious insight that our patterns of life and that our personal psychology may get in the way of believing things that are true. I hurt my voice on that. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, can you give an example? I think I give an example in the book. Sometimes you're dealing with an unbeliever. First of all, they don't want to seriously face the possible realities of heaven and hell. They'd rather divert themselves, distract themselves. Okay? Secondly, they may not want to engage in any activities that might show them it's true, even if it is, because they don't want it to be true. This sometimes happens. I think what's ingenious about Pascal is he's saying, look, you're not just a brain in a vat. You're not a computer on wheels. You're a human person with emotions. You have reason. You have passions. And sometimes the passions get in the way of reason. So I think what he's saying is, look, this is a very high-stakes situation. You need to know that. You need to comport yourself properly. And you need to act in such a way that you might be open to finding the truth. I mean, an example that I gave, I'm not sure if I gave in the book, I gave it in one of my articles, is a little parable I concocted of two actors, an older actor and a younger actor. Did I use this one in the book? Yeah, I did. You write too much, you can't remember where you wrote things. But the older actor is very reluctant to admit the brilliance of the younger actor, even though critics say he's a brilliant actor. The older actor is no longer getting the kind of parts he used to get. So he's envious of this younger actor. Says, well, he's really not very good. He can't do this role. I've done that role better. And so one way of maybe showing this older actor that the younger actor is in fact quite brilliant is to make him watch his movies over and over again so that it sinks in that, no, he is brilliant and you shouldn't reject him just because you're envious of him. See, the envy can stand in the way of knowing a true proposition. Vices can stand in the way of knowing truth. That is the insight of Pascal. It is not medicate yourself, stupefy yourself, so at some point you end up being a religious drone. As a very uncharitable exegesis of Pascal, and it doesn't fit the rest of the Pensées, where he makes it very clear that passions can hinder an accurate understanding of reality. So the upshot of this is the insights you get from the wager, I think, are we've got to be serious and sober about the fact that Christianity is a high-stakes proposition. We shouldn't try to hide that. Jesus talked about it. It has to do with eternal conditions, reward and punishment, right? Pascal says between heaven and hell is only this life, which is the most fragile thing in the world. And we need to realize that finding truth requires many times a change in behavior. You have to be open. You have to seek. You need some incentive. And it is not religious brainwashing. Moreover, it's not merely an appeal to Christianity to fire insurance. And it's not the final state. You don't want someone coming to Christ just because they don't want to go to hell, period. You want them to understand that Christ is true, that this is real, and this is good. But it is not wrong to lay out the prudential situation to someone. It is not wrong to give them incentive to seek. And it's not wrong to tell them that their passions may get in the way of them finding truth. Now, when you combine these insights with a larger apologetic argument, cosmology, design, morality, the anthropic argument, religious experience argument, it's part of the overall strategy of the Christian apologist. Are you with me on that? I could go on and on about the wager. I've written a lot about it over the years. I've given you some more things to look at there. But that, I think, if one can put it in a nutshell, or if one is forced, as I was, to squeeze it into a nutshell, that is the basic insight we should take away from the wager. And I cannot tell you how many times I've seen the wager misinterpreted and misrepresented. Typically, what anthologies of philosophy of religion will do is take the wager fragment by itself with no explanation of where it came from or how it fit into Pascal's larger argument, and then take it apart. And this fellow did this in this magazine, this journal, Think, in a creative kind of way, and he went through so many stereotypes, and I just got fire in my bones, and I had to respond to it. And thank God they published it. I responded to it. I had a more technical exchange. I'll finish with this. A more technical exchange with a philosopher named Alan Carter, who teaches at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he wrote an article against the wager. I responded. He responded to me, and I responded to him. So there are four total articles. And I also debated him. In 2002, I went to see you and engaged in a live debate, which he had set up completely to my disadvantage. And I think I held my own, but I will never do a debate like that again. He set it up to favor himself and to disadvantage me. It's not a good idea if you can help it. I think I came off all right at the time.